about the thought of a couple very important people who have addressed the topic about justice and secularity, and then hopefully ask a few questions, and then, we'll see how it goes from there. I want to talk, first of all, about what the appeal is. It often seems fairly obvious, but what's the appeal of secularism? Right? Why do people want to be secularists? Why do we want a secular account of justice that does sort of everything we want an account of justice to do? And that's one of the things we're going to be talking about. What do we want an account of justice to do? Because that's actually a fairly new development, historically, right, is secularism as an ideal. And it has a lot to do with recognizing pluralism in our society, right? Particularly what a guy I'm going to talk about a little bit called John Rawls calls reasonable pluralism, where reasonable people disagree with each other reasonably. This is a topic that I'm endlessly fascinated with. Where people who are of goodwill, sound mind, are not, hopelessly ignorant, disagree with each other quite profoundly on matters of justice, on matters of the common good, and so on and so forth. And we are increasingly, but have been for some time, a society wherein we recognize that there is this reasonable pluralism, where people disagree with each other. Reasonable people disagree with each other reasonably. And the hope for a secular account of justice is that there is some account of justice that we can all buy into, right? That we can all accept, that all reasonable people will say, yes, right? I can accept that. Whether, for whatever reasons they may come to it, it's what Rawls calls an overlapping consensus, right? I, as a Christian, may affirm it for my Christian reasons. A Buddhist may affirm it for Buddhist reasons. A Marxist for Marxist reasons. But the point is, we all share this basic content. And then we can solve our problems and work out our disputes and our disagreements on the basis of that, right? That secular account of justice that we can all agree to, right? Regardless of what else we disagree with. And that's, it's a beautiful social hope in its own way. As long as it's really possible. Because if it's not possible and we just pretend that it's possible, then what we're doing essentially is excluding people, calling people who are reasonable unreasonable, and keeping them out from that discourse. Right? And so that's going to be one of the main things. Is this idea of a secular account of justice where there can be an overlapping consensus, is it something we can reasonably hope for? I'm going to talk about that adjective a lot, reasonably. Reasonably is an adverb, pardon me. Forgetting my grade 10 grammar education. So here's how Rawls does it. Rawls is sort of in the history, in 20th century political thought, he's the guy that it's almost impossible to write a paper about political thought in the 20th century without mentioning him somewhere. I've sworn to myself when I'm beginning to write papers, I'm not going to talk about Rawls in this one. I always end up talking about Rawls. John Rawls, he was an American philosopher, died 15 years ago or so. And he tried to imagine for himself and his audience how you could generate this account of justice, some principles of justice that all reasonable people could accept. Right? That regardless of their reasons for accepting it, they can sort of see, hey, yeah, that's justice, and then you have this common ground for solving our disputes, right? Disputes about economic distribution, disputes about, say, the permissibility of abortion, and so on and so forth. And then we would have this common language. And he did it by imagining people behind what he called a veil of ignorance. He said, obviously this isn't actually possible, but it doesn't matter. It's a thought experiment, and philosophers love that. He says, imagine that you took a bunch of people and you asked them to write some basic principles of justice for a society that they were going to then drop dead and wake up living in. So, essentially rebuilding a social contract. They're going to drop dead and live in this society, so they're writing for a society of their own. But the key is, they don't know who they'll be in that society, right? They don't know whether they'll be rich or poor, male or female, gay or straight, young or old, etc., etc., etc. Right? So they don't know who they're going to be in this society, so they need to come up with some principles of justice. He says, people behind that veil of ignorance would create principles of justice that are fair. And he thinks that's just. He calls his theory justice as fairness. Right? So that everybody has a fair chance, a fair crack, a fair shake, fair standing before the law, and so on and so forth. That's what these people are going to create. And he actually comes up with two basic principles. I don't know if this is getting too technical. You can just ignore it if it's not. The first principle is a principle of equal liberty. Everybody should be equally free, subject only to the restriction that that they don't interfere with other people's freedoms, right? Classic liberalism. And the other one was what he called the difference principle. And the difference principle was that the only kinds of inequality that would be permissible in this society would be inequalities that actually benefit the least well-off, right? So this is where he departs from sort of mainstream American liberalism and shows himself to be the Democrat that he was. Ah, thank you very much. Well, I don't know if he's a registered Democrat, right, but he's a left liberal. But he thinks that if people thought about it, if they imagined themselves in that original position, behind that veil of ignorance, as we all can do, he said, they'll see that these are fair principles of justice. Once you've got these two, you can derive a whole bunch of interesting stuff from it, but you've got the basic principles on which, according to which reasonable people will debate. And this actually sort of becomes a test of who's reasonable and who's not. Are you willing to accept these principles of justice as the terms under which we're going to, well, have our disputes about abortion and same-sex marriage and economic distribution and all sorts of other things like that, right? That actually becomes the test for who's actually reasonable. And then that, in turn, becomes a test for whether or not Rawls is being reasonable. But that's his hope. There's these basic principles that everyone can accept, at least reasonable people can accept, that then can form the basis of our ongoing discussions. So that if we're going to argue about abortion, Christians like me don't have to start quoting the Bible, and Marxists don't have to start quoting Marx, because we've got something, and then, of course, not really be able to actually have a conversation as far as he could see, because, you know, they don't recognize the authority of Scripture, I don't recognize the authority of capital, and, right, we've got nowhere to go, right? Whereas if there's this common ground, we share these principles of justice, we've got something to go on. That's Rawls's hope. Just going to take a sip of my tea. Dramatic effect. It's delicious. Just in case you were wondering. All right. There's another figure, Jürgen Habermas. In many ways, for much of his career, he shared a very similar hope to Rawls's. That if we can articulate, by sort of working out a thought experiment, what some basic principles for ongoing dialogue would be. He put a great deal of hope in reasonable people arguing with each other in open, frank, and fair ways, and that doing so would lead us towards genuinely just outcomes. But the terms under which that argument was going to go had to be secular, on his view. In technical terms, it had to be based on people's moral views and not their ethical views. Ethical views had to do with your understanding of the good life and what it means to be human and the best form of life for human beings and so on. He thought, okay, people differ too much about that, but we can agree on basic points of sort of procedural moral fairness, right? Everybody gets a chance to speak. Everybody gets treated with respect. Everybody should appeal to reasons that other people can accept, right? Sounds kind of reasonable, actually. It doesn't make any sense. If I'm trying to convince you to agree with me about, I don't know, oil sands development, it doesn't do any good if I just sit here and read Scripture to you if none of you guys accept the authority of Scripture. Wouldn't do any good. So you limit yourself to reasons that you think other people could accept. However, for Habermas, in the past 15 or 20 years, he's gotten into long discussions, actually, with religious believers. He published a really fascinating one with the Joseph then Cardinal Ratzinger, hence after Benedict the 16th, and now Benedict the 16th, I guess, still. But an interesting exchange where he was sort of brought to confess that language can't be purely secular. That the secular language we have now for talking about justice, especially when we're talking about deep issues with respect to justice, like what is it about human beings that makes it wrong to mistreat or disrespect a human being? What is it about us that makes it wrong for us to do that? Always, no matter what. However good the consequences are. Sometimes, even regardless of whether they're okay with it. Right? What makes sort of questions like that? He said, sort of came to admit, there's sort of what he calls semantic resources that religious people have that there's no secular equivalent for. Right? That we can't translate it into. Now, he's still a secularist. He still has the same hope that Rawls did, that eventually we can find a language that's neutral between all these different worldviews, that's neutral between different religions, that all reasonable people can accept, right? But we're not quite there yet, so it's okay for religious voices to come in. So a good example of this is the language of the image of God, right? He says there's sort of no secular equivalent of that, right? So when religious people say, well, human beings must be treated with dignity. They must be they have basic rights that are inviolable regardless of the great social good that may come from violating it, because they are made in the image of God. Habermas says there's no secular equivalent for that yet. It's untranslatable yet. But in the long term, that's what we need to do. So that's what secular philosophers are trying to do. They're trying to find a language that expresses that image of God stuff without all the baggage, right? Without having to believe in God, for example. So Habermas comes a little bit a step further out of the secularist camp than Rawls did. For Rawls, justice is fairness. Those basic principles of justice can be accepted by all reasonable people, and they're more than sufficient to carry out the kinds of arguments that we need to have in order to decide what a just response to, say, poverty or oil sands development or new pipelines or abortion or something like that is. Habermas comes and says, that's a good goal, but we're not there yet. So let's let, you know, people who cannot speak in a purely secular language still speak in their own, right, in public, right? So let the church, the Catholic Church in the case of his debate with Ratzinger, let the Catholic Church speak in its own voice, speak in a distinctly theological voice in public, and let's listen, right? Let's not say, come if you want to affect public policy, you want to affect public debates, come back to us when you can accept the basic principles of justice. He says that's not fair to them now, because they're saying something that we can't say in a purely secular idiom. Hope that makes sense so far. All right, so that's one of the main things I want to debate. Are there things that can be said in a religious idiom that cannot be said in a secular one? A good example is human beings are made in the image of God, and therefore they have inviolable rights. Right? There's an enormous and fascinating literature on this with people arguing back and forth about the grounding of human rights. How am I doing for time, by the way?
Good. 5 more minutes.
Oh, good. Wow. I got sheets of notes yet. No, I don't actually. All right. Now, there are other people, and I don't mind tipping my hand and say I'm included in this, that say even this, the hope that Habermas still shares, that in the end we can find this completely neutral common ground, this secular common ground that all reasonable people can buy into, that there's a language of speaking about justice, some basic principles of justice that we can all share as long as we're reasonable people. I'm inclined to say it's a forlorn hope. Because any account to give an account of justice implies or depends on certain deep assumptions. Assumptions about who human beings are, what human life is, what it's for, what makes for better and worse human lives, what makes for worthy lives and unworthy lives, dignified lives, undignified lives, and so on and so forth. What philosophers like to call an account of the good life or an account of human flourishing. So when Rawls gives his principles of justice, which he thinks he generates entirely out of, you know, this situation where reasonable people would all be able to agree with each other, he's actually building in some basic assumptions. Not bad evidence for this is that he puts people behind the original behind this veil of ignorance, and what do they come out affirming? Basically constitutional representative democracy. Like, wow, what a surprise. You suddenly wipe away all existing forms of government, you come back with the one you've got. Right? The history of political thought is full of this kind of thing, right? Is, well, it turns out that reason itself tells us that we're basically doing a good job. Right? Perhaps grounds to be skeptical, but not necessarily proof that he's wrong. But the emphasis, for example, in Rawls's account on freedom, first of all, as the primary principle of justice, the principle of equal liberty, says something about what human beings are, how human beings ought to live, what constitutes a dignified human life, and for him that has a lesson with freedom and liberty. Now that's a fairly thick moral assumption that not everybody shares, and that it's not obviously unreasonable for people to disagree with. Right? He wants to find something that all reasonable people can agree with, but if it depends on this notion that what makes human life worthwhile is that it is free, that people are autonomous, that people are able to make their own decisions, well, it's not obvious that that's something that all reasonable people can accept. So, on the one hand, we've got Rawls's view. We've actually got principles of justice that all reasonable people can accept. They're neutral, right? If you can't accept them, you really don't have any part in public conversations because you're being unreasonable. You have Habermas's view that that's a desirable goal, and we're moving in that direction, but we're not there yet. So in the interim, we need to allow languages in public life, languages about justice, that are still religiously inflected, right? Until we can find a good way of translating what, say, Christians mean by the image of God into a secular idiom, okay? And then the third one, I'll stand as a representative for this, but if you want names, I can name a whole bunch of them, right? Is the idea that there is no purely neutral, right? That this hope that Rawls and Habermas share is, in fact, you can't make good on it. There is not and cannot be a purely neutral language for justice that all reasonable people can accept, unless you start defining reasonableness in such a way that you actually exclude a whole bunch of reasonable people, right? I like to think I'm reasonable, but I'm not sure I could speak about justice in a purely secular idiom. There's lots of interesting overlaps, right? In some ways, I don't think that the two principles of justice are bad political principles. They're pretty good political principles, but I don't think they're the fundamental ones. Right. So you got these three ideas. See, if I was teaching now, I'd have this all on the board, and you'd be even more confused. Okay? And my students would be like, why can't you do this on a PowerPoint? It's because I don't plan this stuff ahead of time. Okay? My students really do love me. They just don't like it when I try to draw things on the board. All right. So the question is, right, that I think hopefully can get us started on this, is again, are there principles, ideas, or a language for speaking about justice that all reasonable people can accept? Right? That can be the focus of an overlapping consensus. Right? The only people who can't use that language or who feel they have to use a different language are unreasonable people. Right? People who aren't willing to play fair or who just don't have the good sense or knowledge or rational capacity to play fair in public conversation. Or are there ways of speaking about justice that are important and reasonable but not secular? Right? So that's the first question. And then if the latter is true, that there are untranslatable religious ways of speaking about justice that are reasonable, where does that leave us? Where does that leave us with respect to that original hope that we can find a common ground where we all agree so that we can work out our differences fairly without having to fight each other, without having to try to beat each other? Because that's the hope, right? That's Rawls's hope, that's Habermas's hope. Indeed, I share that hope, that there's ways we can work out our disagreements in ways that we don't have to fight each other, whether with violence or even at the ballot box, where voting can be a way of, you know, finally making a decision, but not necessarily how it works in our society, which is voting is a way to make sure my views prevail over others, right? And then politics is just a way of organizing and manipulating people to make sure I win, right? Where politics isn't fundamentally about winning, but but actually getting things more or less morally right. Those are not punchy questions now. Once again, is there untranslatable language for justice, right, that we need in public discussion, but that isn't secular? Second, if that's true, where does that leave us with respect to the hope of finding a common language, right, with finding a way that we can work out our differences and our disagreements in ways that are fair, in ways that are not necessarily adversarial, and in ways that actually make for a better, well, world? So.
We're alive.
All right.
So you've opened up with two very direct, fundamental questions. Why don't we begin there? Who would like to enter in first? I am surprised. Tony, really?
Thanks a lot. I really enjoyed your introductory statement, and I spent this morning reading St. Paul's epistle to the Ephesians, and what you said made me reflect actually on some of my scriptural devotional literature. I guess, in a word, one of my kind of what you've actually inspired in me as a result of what you said is that the way in which you pose these questions I find to be very idealist, and I suppose I'm something more of a materialist. And so for me, judicial systems, legal codes, are actually a reflection of an existing state of historical and social development in any given society, and can only be understood by understanding the content of the history and the culture of any given society. And for that reason, our sense of justice often varies widely in some respects between one society and another. In some societies, it's still regarded as just to amputate my hand if I've stolen, or to stone my wife to death if she's proven to be an adulteress, or to behead me if I can be shown to be an apostate or heretic. Now, in our society, we look unfavorably on those kind of judicial systems. And of course, we've been known to try to impose, at the point of a gun, our own more enlightened, democratic, humanitarian systems. But unfortunately, we often run into great resistance and recalcitrance for those communities that are not prepared to accept our version of justice in quite the same words. So I guess what I'm trying to say in a long-winded sort of way is that the search for a universal form of justice is an idealist way of posing the question, I think. It's kind of sense neo-Kantian, and I have a lot of respect for Kant's categorical imperative, because it does exemplify some of the basic things for most of the world religions. But at the same time, each world religion, we're kind of, as an Eurocentric audience, we are filtering out what we want to hear from those world religions. We don't want to hear, for example, that some of the Christian prophets endorsed slavery, for example, which of course they did, endorsed the total political and legal subordination of a wife to her husband, which of course, in fact, they did. And I'm sure if I was to read the Talmud and the Quran, I would find equal parallel representatives. But rather than demonizing, and I have to be careful what I say here, but rather than demonizing as backward and reactionary when the prophet says the slaves should respect their master and the master should respect their slave, rather than demonizing that, I tend to look upon it in its historical and social context and say that the prophet was actually in his own way trying to civilize what were often abuses in his own community. Although he didn't challenge the institution of slavery, he was unlikely to do that in a country where it was an extensive institution. The best he could do was to try to ensure that people treated each other within certain civilized codes and standards. So when we see things in religions which appear to endorse institutions that we have already rejected and moved beyond, sometimes we fail to see that what's actually happening is that religion is still functioning as a civilizing agent within a community where abuses and atrocities, unfortunately, were probably all too common. So I guess, in a way, I'm agreeing with Habermas, but for different reasons, because I think that the justice system very much reflects the social and historical context of its time. As societies industrialize, as they urbanize, as they probably secularize as well, as historical changes take place, the justice systems will begin to transform themselves to reflect these new material realities. And so Habermas, I think, is probably right, because he's assuming that in the long run, traditional belief systems will probably change as a result of the demographic and industrial changes in these countries. The possibilities for elaborating a kind of a common denominator of morality is always on our agenda, because the world is moving in a more unified and globalized direction. So that's, I think, basically what I wanted to say, that the philosophers have interpreted the world, the problem. But Marx also says that every society only asks itself such questions as its historical development now allows it to answer.
Do you want me to? By the way, I don't consider there to be any reason why I should be the first one to respond to anything. If anyone wants to take the floor instead, I've got lots to say about everything. Mm-hmm. But that's the pitfall of being a philosopher, is that you actually know everything, and so it's very difficult to shut up. I think in some ways you're right, that the way I couch things is in some sense idealist, right? Talking about ideas, talking about concepts and principles of justice, talking about public language and so on. But there has to be material conditions for those kinds of things to happen, right? In order for us to even be able to be reasonable and have reasonable discussions, certain material conditions have to be in place, or other material conditions can be obstacles there, right? Where there's widespread economic inequality, the material conditions for reasonable discussion are simply not there, because a lot of people are denied the educational opportunities, the material resources, and so on and so forth in order to be able to get that. But if we're talking about justice, right, then I don't think we can be complete materialists, right? If we're going to talk about justice as something we strive for and hope for, and that justice as a norm for making, say, political decisions or social decisions or something like that, then a sort of pure materialism just invites sort of, well, you know, justice just is what the material conditions of our society, the economic distribution, the power structures and legal system and so on allow, then it's hard for it to function as a norm, right? That we want to be more just. This is unjust, that's one. It's very telling that in Capital, say Karl Marx, right, the great materialist, found himself unable to say that that capitalism is unjust. He says it's self-contradictory, it's doomed, but he cannot bring himself to say that it's unjust. For my part, I'm not willing to lose that language of justice, right? I think we should evaluate modern capitalism in accordance with the question of whether or not it is just. Right? So if we're going to be using that language, we can't be pure materialists about it. But we do well to discipline our idealism, right? And that's a danger that especially someone like Rawls falls into with his, well, we can get principles of justice just by sort of imagining people in this impossible situation where they're creating principles of justice for a society that they're going to live in, but they don't know who they are. Well, right, a good Marxist would, of course, sneer and say, well, yeah, they know perfectly well who they are, right? They know which class they're a member of. And when we try to engage in that thought experiment, we can't stop being who we are either, right? But if we're going to talk about justice, my disposition is to say we need to not go entirely in for the materialist response, which tends to just be a bit of a shrug. We actually, you know, with respect to, well, what is just, it's whatever we sort of, whatever works here according to our standards.
Just a really quick riposte to that. I think the benefit of a materialist analysis is that it forces us, as Marx showed us actually, that the call for justice is always based on an understanding of not only the limitations of the period under which we're living, but the opportunities which are currently being suppressed by the system under which we live. Because as a materialist, as a dialectical materialist, Marx was very, and I don't want to reduce this just to Marx, but his way of thinking, in a sense, sensitizes us to the fact that each historical period brings its new crop of opportunities, which old political and economic structures may try to suppress. But no society poses questions which are totally unanswerable by its material conditions. I mean, my sense of justice as an animal rights activist may be, if it were a just world we're living in, no sentient creature would be butchered for my survival. But for various reasons, our society maybe does not have the material basis to incorporate that into its judicial codes. Maybe we're not ready. Maybe the resources within our society haven't been developed to enable that to be posed as a moral problem. But the time will come when it will be posed as a moral problem. So the usefulness of a materialist analysis is it shows us, it makes us think about the development of society and the new resources and opportunities which have been created, but which are being suppressed by existing political and economic systems.
And on that, I'll agree with you 100%. That's a wonderful thing about reasonable disagreements, is it often turns out that you're actually agreeing with each other when you get down to it.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. When you were talking about Rawls and Habermas, it occurred to me that Rawls should have tried to live for 10 years or so behind the whale. He would have really found a big difference in the world. The second thing about Habermas is that, what you were saying about Habermas was remind me of Karl Popper and his idea of promissory materialism, where scientists who believe in materialism will come about and say that, well, the whole world will be materialist at a certain point in time. But that's not going to happen. But what I'm trying to get to is that it's like what Tony said earlier on, is that these people, Rawls and Habermas, lived in political contexts. So what was Rawls arguing with? What was Habermas arguing with? Why did he say what he did? What did Rawls say why he did? They lived in the U.S., they lived in Germany, Europe. They're battling with the Enlightenment, or the Enlightenment's battle with the with Christendom. Those are the context in which they argue. And the whole world doesn't begin in the 20th century. Justice has been debated, argued about in other cultures around the world, in Chinese, in Arabic, in Swahili, in Hindu, in Hindi, whatever you want. So how are you going to incorporate those people into an abstract idea of justice? I don't think it's possible. Because, again, coming back to what Tony said, when somebody wants to argue about injustice, they will argue from particular circumstances. It's not arguing in an abstract sense. When you have murder or crimes committed, there are always particular contexts. In a court, after all, the jury, the judge, they all try and find out what particular circumstances led to that crime. So, how do you then reconcile an idealist justice with these issues?
Yeah.
I'm strongly inclined to agree with you on that. Both Rawls and Habermas are trying to defend the Enlightenment and the hope of the Enlightenment, right? That there is a common human nature and a common human reason that whatever cultural superstructure we've built over it everywhere, there is just this common core. And that we can find ways to drill down to that. And once we've done that, we've found something. And for both of them, it's some kind of reason. So they both have complex arguments about this kind of stuff. And we can get into that if that's desirable, but probably not. Right? Is that they say they have that same kind of cultural core. That may be highly naive or sort of beautiful as sort of a utopian hope. But it's so easy when you do that to hit something that's your culture and think you've hit the universal core. Right? And then, if that's the universal core, then only unreasonable people don't recognize it. And therefore, people who don't recognize it are unreasonable, right? And that's one of the big dangers with at least this approach to secularism, right? Is it says, well, here's a universal language, a secular language that works and is applicable, can help us reach fair decisions, in ways that all reasonable people can agree with. And therefore, anybody who insists on bringing in other languages, be it Confucian, be it obviously religious, be it Buddhist, et cetera, is sort of being unreasonable if they insist on that, right? Which then just uses a Western post-Enlightenment standard of reasonableness as the fundamental standard measuring everyone, right? It mistakes that standard as for universal human nature, when in fact it's largely just an artifact, albeit maybe a true artifact, but still an artifact of a particular culture, right? And that's one of the big dangers with secularism. And this is one thing that Habermas began to recognize when he sort of said, okay, you know what? This question about translatability, right? I don't want to keep religious voices out of things too quickly, because they do say things that we can't say. So we haven't yet hit that universal secular language. Right, he still hopes for it,
but it becomes sort of a an idealization, right, that creates a norm to pursue. But he doesn't want to assume we've got it yet, right? Because it can just be deeply ethnocentric to say, well, all reasonable people basically agree with me, right? And that's a condition for reasonableness. I don't know if that's sort of where you're
going. But I mean,
okay.
No, it's okay.
Push it.
I mean, you know, the thing is, what I'm trying to get to is justice is, number one, very particular. And number two, which culture are we talking about? You know, mm-hmm. We can get away. We can't get away by saying that yes, it's Eurocentric or it's universal. That it's not going to work anymore. I mean, I think the problem. One of the things we're trying to do in Canada today is trying to find some kind of common ground. Mm-hmm. Whether how that'll come about, we don't know. But you know, there has been a certain point of view imposed on everybody else. The quote-unquote European civilization has imposed its own view around the world. And that is being increasingly questioned, pushed back. And what we're finding out is a whole lot of multiple views of the world, a whole lot of multiple views of justice of the world, and what it does mean to be human. You know, it's like we may not, I think all of, at a certain point in time, we'll all agree that it's not good to cut somebody's hands off if you've stolen. But we may not.
Yep.
How do we know that? You know, and coming back to reasonableness, you know, people like Locke, for instance, he is a poster child for neoliberals, and yet he was a venture capitalist in slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how is it that people who then, or George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, these were presidents of the U.S., they owned human beings. You know, how did they reconcile this thing to themselves? I often wonder. I'm sure you do too. So what kind of world are we coming to that we will be able to treat each other respectfully, yes, you know, reasonable? This is another idea about reason. Sorry if I'm wandering too like you. Reason is like, you know, again, it's a very, very enlightenment concept, you know, in which intelligence, as thought of earlier, before the Enlightenment, has been reduced to reason.
Mm-hmm.
Intelligence was much more than reason. You know, it was consciousness. So, anyway, that's just throwing that stuff out.
Yeah.
But thanks.
So, I just wanted to kind of get, first of all, one clarification and then make an additional comment. So, when Habermas agrees that there's some things that are said in religious language, like the image of God, humans being made in the image of God, that can't be translated in secular languages, is that there is no secular idiom in which we can speak of that, or is it somehow, as a category, secular conceptions of the good are somehow deficient? And it's more of a categorical distinction rather than that there's an incommensurability between these languages and any sort of secular conception of why humans are, well, to use a religious term, sacred. Fails because of it doesn't really capture the distinct nature of religion rather than somehow being categorically deficient in some way.
For clarification's sake, Habermas, I don't think he would admit to anything, any two languages being fundamentally and permanently incommensurable.
Okay.
Right? That with enough work, we can say the things the others are saying. It's just it takes work, and it takes really mining down to, well, the conditions of possibility for speech at all. He's a Kantian, once we get down there, then we can find a way of doing it. It's just at this point, secular European North American culture has not yet found a language for that that does what the language of the image of God does. Right.
Okay, so that's just. And to me, that just seems to be complete, like a mischaracterization on his part. I would tend to disagree with Rawls for other reasons, but I think the expectation that we would be able to say the exact same thing with two different languages is just going to be confused in some way. Because I would see the Kantian rationalist idea of why humans have worth and demand dignity as being a secular account on its own that is in. Well, I'm personally more attracted to it than the Christian one. I wouldn't necessarily see it as, oh, we aren't saying the same thing. They both are serving the same function at a higher abstract level. So I'm suspicious of the idea that we would need to be able to say the exact same thing to get over this sort of problem. It seems like it's a, sorry to make this a little clear, I'm kind of rambling, but I guess I don't see the political problem as necessarily a problem about reaching the truth as so much a problem of reasonable terms of association. And I know that's kind of a typical liberal type of answer, but I think if you try to conflate the two, then you're doing two, trying to make this sort of dialogue and reason, two different kinds of reason. There's the reason that we elect that allows us to, or the traits that we have that allow us to live together, and those that are those that allow us to reach a better understanding of the world. And while they dovetail in a lot of ways, I think it's wise to kind of keep those separate and not to conflate them.
Okay. I definitely see your point. And it can sometimes, with these debates about, you know, translatability and the grounds for human rights and stuff, can seem very sort of abstract. And then it's like, well, I thought the problem was just how are we going to be able to live with each other, right? I think trying to make too strong of a division between those questions, however, isn't going to work when it gets to brass tacks. Because if we're going to say use the language of rights as a way of talking about how we're going to live with each other, right? I'm going to let you believe what you believe or do what you do, as long as you don't violate my rights or anyone else's rights, right? That's, you know, good liberal. Those are the sort of the grounds of sort of social cooperation and toleration, right? As we denominate it in the language of rights. And on the whole, that works fairly well, except when it doesn't. Right? And we can do that in a way that, well, we can all sort of use that language, and we may mean slightly different things, but we can more or less agree that if you come up and kick me in the shins for no reason, you violated my rights. But if someone, say, who owns a florist shop is asked to participate in something, say, a homosexual marriage that they believe is sinful, do they have the right to refuse? All of a sudden, it's tough. We don't yet know whether or not, or we both sides think they know, but we collectively haven't yet worked out whether or not that's a fair term of social cooperation, right? If that's if those are rights that people have. And we start pursuing that, and we get to real questions about, well, what gives people rights in the first place, right? What is it about people that they have rights? Do the rights of say religious people to be able to carry out their lives, including their business lives, in accordance with their religious conscience, do those trump the rights of homosexual people to be, well, to expect to be served and treated with respect when they, you know, when they go out into the business world, etc.? And solving that means really facing these questions about, well, in the end, how do we talk about rights? And we all think we're right about this. So the question of truth has to obtrude. So the question, well, okay, we're going to have to argue about this. So what are the terms under which we're going to argue about it? Right? When we talk about the ground of rights, can I talk about the image of God? If I do that, am I being fair to people who don't agree with me whether that there's a God? Right? And I don't know if that's addressing the concern, but those are the kinds of places, and I think they're more common than we tend to assume, where these questions about the language that we use becomes very important, right? Granting the things that that these language are materially embedded, culturally embedded, and all sorts of other things, right? But when we have to find terms under which we're going to live together. We have to solve this, right? Maybe I'm naive to hope that we can solve it without one side having to just beat the other, right? To just win. But that we can do it in a way that even the people who don't necessarily get their way can say, all right, I was done fairly by, right? That may be naivete on my part, but...
And broadly, I agreed with everything you said, and I think that the disagreement would come on the point of, I'm skeptical of the idea of that there won't be any situation in which we will have to say it'll be power that has determined this, rather than not be so much because when we're speaking of justice, it's just the way things are and it's just power, but so much because it seems to me that we can never reduce the good to a single set of values that are harmonious. There's internal conflicts between them. And something like religious conscience is extremely valuable, and something like that reciprocal respect is also equally important. I don't think in any sort of abstract sense we can ever say, oh, in this situation, this one takes the better. And I can't see a situation when any amount of argumentation would resolve that issue.
Okay, fair enough.
Actually, my question was very much along the lines of yours. I was thinking in terms of your human commonalities. Perhaps the underlying commonality that we have is that, in fact, we do want to win. And if that's the case, then all of this is a lost exercise.
Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to agree with that, but I don't want to give up too soon, right? If it's true that in the end, speaking about justice is just a fancy rhetorical way of trying to beat the other person, or trying to win, or have your views prevail, then, I mean, the language of justice is, in sort of Marxist terms, pure false consciousness. It's ideological, right? And we'd be better off without it. I don't want to give up the ghost on that too early, right? It often is, right? It often is a smokescreen, right? For sort of just trying to win, just trying to have my preferred way of living prevail. Sometimes deliberately, sometimes not. But I, for my part, and this largely comes from the fact that I'm a Christian, right? I think that there's reason to hope for better, right? That justice can function as a norm, right? That when if we say something like, okay, use a nice trivial example, walking up to someone and kicking them in the shins for no reason is unjust, that it's actually unjust, right? Not just that I'm saying something more than I would prefer it if we didn't do that because I'm worried that I'm going to get my shins kicked more often than I'm going to kick someone else, right? That there's actually, it's actually wrong. And that if there's a society somewhere where kicking people in the shins for no reason is commonly accepted, that's still unjust. Right? Regardless of how commonly they accept it or how well integrated it is into their economic system or their religious system or something like that. Right? To be able to use the language of justice as a term by which to evaluate normatively not just one's own culture, but potentially others, or not just one's own political system, but others. Right? It's a complicated thing. It's a thing that it's very dangerous to do, but it's something I think we can't avoid. Except perhaps by just giving up the ghost on using that language at all, right? Just saying, well, it's just all power, right? Going to sort of the skeptical Foucauldian route or Nietzsche, right? It's just all power, and hence, right? May the best, most clever user of the language of justice win. I don't know if that was sort of what you were concerned about.
Well, it seems to be I'm an atheist, so I yeah. I stand differently. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that what you're positing are absolutes, that existence of those absolutes.
Yep.
And and you know, if you don't posit those, then again you're you know.
Yeah. Yeah, my inclination is that the only alternative, as it were, to positing absolutes, but not to be too absolutistic about it. Like, I want to be fallibilistic about it. I'm probably wrong about justice in a lot of cases, right? But that doesn't necessarily change the fact that some things are just and some things aren't. I'm just probably wrong about some of them, but other times I'm not. My inclination is to think that in the end, the only alternative to saying that, to taking sort of an absolutist approach to justice, is just abandoning the project altogether of trying to be more just. That when we engage in disputes about justice, we each have to presume that there is such a thing as justice, and that I'm right about it and you're wrong, or you're right about it and I'm wrong, right? Because the only alternative then is just to try to beat each other. Right? And for me, okay, if that's the way it is, I'm very sorry for the world and for myself. I'm just not quite ready to admit that, right? I know that there's a lot of, you know, questions about intervening there, right, with respect to moral absolutes and so on. But if we're really committed to working out our differences and our disagreements civilly by talking to each other, by arguing with each other, by engaging in political life with each other in a way that's more than just trying to beat the other side, because politics can just be that, but it doesn't have to be. Sometimes it's not. Then we have to assume that there is something like justice, right? And there's a truth about it, even if we should hopefully take a fallibilist approach, right? Because if I think I'm entirely right about justice, then there's no point talking either. But on the other hand, if there's no truth about it, then what's the point in talking? Let's just see who wins.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I quite agree with you that one has to have sort of an absolute sense of justice in order to maintain some notion of justice. Why not just maintain the notion that what we call justice is a social convention which does the least harm to one another? So in other words, it's a way of, you know, for instance, in our society where we have pluralistic cultures and ideations, etc. So we come to sort of a kind of compromise. Is justice for our purposes here and now? In other words, what will work is a form of justice.
Kind of, but I think you've just implicitly defined justice as that which does the least harm. Right?
Allows us to live together.
You might, well, okay, well, yeah. Then justice is, right? But again, you've created a definition of justice that then you use as a norm for which to evaluate, well, are we doing things well or poorly? And which is a question of truth to a certain extent. Justice can't simply be what works, because what counts as what works? It works when I win, but if my winning means killing a lot of people, then that's not justice, is it? That's just winning. Right, to be able to distinguish between doing justice and winning, well, I'm inclined to think that, however tacitly, as long as you want to make that to have that distinction, you have to appeal to some kind of a conception of justice that says there is such a thing as justice, and we can either no one's completely right about it, but there is such a thing, right? And absolutist in that sense.
Well, one could say yes, there is a norm that we apply to say, in other words, that the compromises to which we're prepared to, or the compromises we're prepared to enter, mm-hmm. are ones that appear to do the least harm.
Right.
You know, so you that if we that becomes the criteria then, but it's still not an absolute thing. We're just saying, well, it appears to us this does the least harm.
Right. But again, my disposition is that saying that, and I tend to, I like that to a certain extent, you've implied that the standard by which we're going to evaluate how we use the language of justice is that which does the least harm. And that's your principle of justice, right? You sound like John Stuart Mill, right? Estimable fellow that he was, though I'm not a utilitarian myself, right? Is, justice just is what does the least harm. But that's held as, well, that's, utilitarians have no other principle besides that one, but they cleave to that one, right? That's sort of the absolute principle. Do as little harm as possible, right? Because there are other conceptions of justice that say, it's not really about harm, right? It's, certain things are perfectly acceptable, even if they lead to a great deal of harm, if they are in accordance with, I don't know, the will of God, or they're in accordance with the flourishing of this particular people who are the best or most exciting or most lovely people or something like that, right? And so then you actually have a disagreement about what justice is. And disagreeing with someone implies that there's a truth about it. Otherwise, you're not disagreeing with each other. You're simply not talking to each other.
But isn't there another issue here, Fred, around the least harm? How do you evaluate that?
Yeah.
I mean, where there are situations of deep competing virtue, how do you evaluate it? Like, isn't there something behind that?
Well, I suppose there is. There is the idea, I agree, that doing the least harm, I mean, it takes you back another step. Mm-hmm. What would that least harm be? Mm-hmm. But in fact, though, see, when I hear you, it appears to me that you're saying, well, there is, you know, sort of like this argument about, you know, your idealistic position on this, but there is an ideal of justice that we have on some basis, whether it's, you know, based on a theological position or sort of the idea that reason would reveal it in due course of time. I'm not sure there is such a thing. There is only sort of a kind of muddling through, mm-hmm. which minimizes the conflict that we get into. That's not to say that we can't do things, you know, that we can cause great harm in the name of God, mm-hmm. in the name of ideologies, etc. But that's because we believe that, or at some level, the argument being made is that there would be greater harm if we didn't do, you know, mm-hmm. the middling harms, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure exactly, you know, mm-hmm. I don't think mine is quite the same as the same kind of notion of justice in an absolute sense than yours is.
Yeah, but again, I think it would come down if we really pursue this great deal. Well, what do you mean by harm? Which harms count and which ones don't? And again, I think that you're going to get to a place where we actually disagree with each other, but my sort of background point here is that real disagreement implies a norm of truth. Okay? If otherwise we don't disagree, we're simply talking past each other. Right? And if we're going to share a hope that we can muddle through by engaging in disagreements, a presupposition of that hope is that our disagreements are really disagreements, that we're not simply just talking past each other. So if we got down to questions about, well, what counts as harm, right? If I use the force of law to force you to do good, are you harmed? You probably think so, but I would tend to think, of course you're not harmed. I've just made you good, right? Think about the most obvious one, right? Is if I threaten to, you know, burn heretics alive to force them to recant their heresy, have I harmed them? By no means, right? I've done them spiritual good. Now, I don't actually believe that, just to be clear, right? I'm not in favor of burning heretics.
I thought you were Dutch.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, I'm a Calvinist, too. I was in favor of burning Servetus, but he had it coming, okay? Look it up on Wikipedia. I don't think he had it coming. But if anybody has it coming, Servetus did. So we're going to have to dig in there to say about harm. But there's little point in our digging in and having that conversation unless we sort of posit that there is, well, that there's a proper definition of harm, and that at least one of us is wrong about it, right? Possibly both of us are, but at least one of us is wrong about it, because that's how disagreements work. Yeah.
I just want to disagree with you that you can't. That I think what you're saying is that you have to be some sort of an absolutist in order to justify having any argument whatsoever. And I don't think that's right. Suppose that we had a conception of justice which was tied very closely to custom. One of the clear criteria for what's just is dependent on what's been the custom. For example, medieval peasants would argue that they were being treated unjustly because the Lord was violating time and immemorial customs, etc. But customs differ from society to society, and hence, if that's what you mean by justice, justice is going to be relative to societies, right? But there could be arguments about it, right? I mean, somebody might be wrong within that context. You know, they might have misinterpreted what the customs were, right? And this, of course, fits in with what Tony was saying about a materialist conception of justice. And that is, a society evolves in a certain way, and the criteria that you're going to use for settling disputes about what's fair are going to be different in different societies because of the way they have materially evolved in different directions. But that doesn't rule out having arguments, right? To make it even clearer, take the word legal. Suppose we start arguing about what's legal. Well, legal is a relative term. I mean, it's there's what's legal in Canada, what's legal in the United States, what's legal in Britain, what's legal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's relative. It's not absolute. But you have arguments about it. I mean, that's what the Supreme Court does most of the time, right? And somebody can be right and somebody can be wrong. And I think that's all. That's what people are saying here. Habermas and Rawls are trying to do is set up a kind of construction of justice which would, I don't know about Habermas, but certainly with the case of Rawls, a conception of justice which would apply across all societies. And you can make judgments on the basis of that, regardless of what the development of any particular society was.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you in some ways. But if you sort of take the peasant and his lord arguing about justice on the basis of custom, they're disagreeing precisely because there is some objective standard to which they both appeal, right? And that's custom, and that's the custom in this case, right? And similarly, in a court of law, right? There's an interesting case, right, about this, you know, upskirt photography or so, something like that, right? And the person was sort of allowed, at least temporarily, to have done this because it wasn't technically against the law. But there's still an appeal to an objective standard.
Yeah, look, but that's right. Different than absolutism. That's what I'm pushing here.
Yes.
I mean, you can have objectivity without absolutism.
I'm slightly inclined to agree, except when you start realizing that these conversations have a tendency to push through those more immediate objectives, right? So even our laws, right? It's written right into our laws that our laws are only valid insofar as they're, well, okay, it's not quite that, right? There's appeal to the concept of fundamental justice, right? Or in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, actions that are demonstrably justifiable in a free and democratic society and so on and so forth. So even the law itself, as sort of the first line of objective discussion, recognizes that real discussion about the law has to push past the letter of the law itself. And then we actually have to end up disagreeing, or hopefully agreeing, about what the principles of fundamental justice are, or what norms, or what actions are demonstrably justifiable. Once you get there,
I wasn't saying you were wrong about being a sort of mild absolutist.
Yeah.
I was just saying that your argument against the relativists was not valid.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I'm wrong about a lot of things. I just don't know what those are until someone tells me. And the same is true for all of you.
The question seems to be whether or not it's possible to have an absolute sense of justice independent of some form of religion or some sort of external justification. But I don't think anyone's brought up the sort of fundamental aspect of human nature, which seems to be from experiments carried out within the, you know, recently within the last few years, that there is a sort of basic human sense of fairness and justice and altruism that people, even from a very early age, exhibit, and even perhaps other species exhibit to some extent. So it would seem that if you want a commonality between cultures that perhaps isn't religious, but maybe the true underlying basis of religious morality as far as human interactions, trying to make it conform to a reasonable extent with that underlying human nature would seem the sort of an uncorrupted nature that isn't warped by the need for capitalist competition or anything like that, or you know, the kind of things that we see. But a more fundamental human nature may be a basis for some kind of a commonality between different cultures on the sense of justice and fairness.
Yeah, I'm familiar with some of that research, and it's very interesting and compelling. And it's sort of, you know, it's another way of getting to this idea that there's hope, that there's some fundamental common right morality that we already kind of know that can be the basis, right? And it's in common, so that, you know, we all have it in the same way, and we all kind of know. So all of a sudden, there's these neutral terms under which we can sort of work out our differences, basic human decency, language like that. My inclination is to say with that kind of thing, it's probably right. I mean, you know, I'm a Christian, and I'm the kind of Christian who believes in natural law. So it's like, yeah, good. Well, Thomas Aquinas could have told you this a long time ago, except he wouldn't have done it through psychological mechanisms. But the problem is that, well, here culture comes in, and here I'm going to start sounding like the relativist and the materialist that I was just sort of arguing against, but I like to think I'm like Hegel, you know, both and. That's what's so great about Hegel. You can't disagree with him because he already agrees with you about everything. But he also agrees with the people with whom you disagree. Those kinds of the basic sort of biological seeds, that hardwiring or something like that, are developed, articulated, and so on culturally in such profoundly different ways that nobody acts entirely from sort of that hardwired, built-in compassion or sensitivity or something like that. No one ever acts purely from that, because we're human beings, and hence we're cultural beings too, is that we've been trained to be sensitized to certain kind of suffering and not others. Right? We've been trained to respond to that kind of suffering in this way but not that way. And so there's sort of no neutral way to identify exactly what those common human dispositions are, and then to sort of make a framework for human cooperation on that, right? Is that any attempt to articulate that is going to bring in certain kinds of norms, right? Certain kinds of harm or suffering count, and certain ones don't. Certain people's suffering or harm counts, and certain people's don't. Or certain species count, and certain species don't, and so on. And although, you know, I welcome the idea that we sort of have this common disposition, right, towards compassion, towards sympathy with others, towards concern for fairness. The cultural development and articulation of that is such that it won't work purely as a, you know, in itself as a basis for sort of cooperation, right? It needs to be articulated culturally, whether that's religiously or in the language of sort of post-Enlightenment philosophy or what have you. Right? I don't know if that's addressing where you're...
Well, of course, there are the cultural aspects of it, as you point out, but still, it at least in a theoretical conceptual framework, it provides a way of, you know, getting at a more fundamental sense of justice that's not entirely cultural, that is not religious or you know, has any need for a God for justification, but it might be an entirely secular phenomenon, but still transcends or at least provides a basis for the cultural concepts that we have of things like fairness and justice.
Yeah, I mean, the sticking point there might be identifying it as that underlying basis as secular and not in need of religious, right? My inclination is to say, again, because I'm a Christian, I believe everything is created by God. Everything needs a religious explanation in the end, right? I would identify that orientation towards justice and fairness and compassion as natural law, which is inexplicable in purely secular terms. You can have the evolutionary psychologist, on the other hand, and say, no, we can explain it entirely in secular terms, hence, you know, language of natural selection and so on and so forth, right? Whether we have to include group selection and so on. So, right, they're going to have arguments about that. But that's, again, the sticking point, right? And in arguing about that, I'm going to be characterizing those basic dispositions differently than the evolutionary psychologist is. I'm going to think it needs to be worked out in a different way than the evolutionary psychologist is. We're disagreeing because we're talking about the same thing. But my, you know, I would, you'd have to work pretty hard to convince me that I could see that as entirely secular, and presumably the evolutionary psychologist, I'd have to work pretty darn hard to convince them that this isn't a secular phenomenon at all, right? Which means that at least one of us is wrong, again, going back to the absolutist standard.
Well, just as far as, I mean, it just seems to me that we were always looking at it from the point of view that religion provides morality, you know, whether or not you agree with it. But I think it might be the other way around, that if you look at the different religions, you have a basic commonality in how man is supposed to treat the fellow man and fellow creatures. And it would seem to me that it's more accurate to say that the religious morality comes from the natural biological morality. So you don't need, you know, the religious aspects are just one way of looking at it, but you don't need it in order to have that underlying morality. You can just go to a more fundamental biological aspect.
Yeah, I mean, it may surprise you that I'm actually kind of inclined to agree with you. I don't think religion creates morality. I think God does. And those are different things, right? Absolutely, right? But that's the classic natural law theory, whether you want to put it in the language of evolutionary biology or not. That however benighted the atheist may be, and please understand that I'm being slightly, you know, that I'm being cute here, right? That they're capable of recognizing some basic principles of how to get along, regardless of, you don't have to believe in God in order to be good, right? But that is, it may yet be true that you cannot, that there couldn't be goodness without God, right? And this is not the forum to get into that long description.
Well, I'm getting really lost in the realm of the theoretical right now.
Fair enough.
It's out there.
Nice in here, isn't it?
And the other thing I'm lost in is two things have really caught my attention, particularly the one about right, least right, most right, because right away I'm thinking of the Ukraine, Russia, you know, is it going to be least harmful if we let Russia do what it wants and keep the oil flowing into Europe right now, you know, or is it more harmful to not let that happen, right? And then the other thing is the UN. There's that little entity called the UN, which has many detractors, but I do think, to some degree, with my limited knowledge of what they do, that there is an attempt within their mandate to cover exactly what we are talking about today. How do we get everyone to play in the sandbox nicely? Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it. I'm just, those two things have been coming to mind, and they're both very, very pertinent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how do you bring it out of the realm of theoretical where we are right now? And look at it from a very real perspective.
We're going to take a break for 10, 15 minutes for tea.
Not a bad idea.
And then we'll come back after that. Thanks. Thanks, Michael. Okay, we'll begin again.
So I just wanted to return to the original question of this get-together, which is whether or not secular philosophies adequately articulate all of these questions pertaining to justice. And obviously a very significant part of that is trying to find some sort of common ground on which we can all agree on what justice is. And so certainly when everybody comes to the table trying to find this common ground, everybody's definition of justice is going to be wildly different. They're going to have certain things that they're committed to, others that they're not. And so my question is, can we reduce justice to some sort of common ground without losing its strength? So for instance, let's say somebody comes to this discussion with, you know, let's say 8 commitments about what justice fundamentally is. And when they leave that discussion, those contents are reduced to, let's say, 2 components. Will they be adequately convinced that common ground articulates justice, and is that fair to go forward with? Yeah.
In many ways, again, talking about Rawls, that's his hope, right? He wants a nice minimalist theory of justice that everyone can accept. People are welcome to embellish on that in any way. As long as you accept those things, we're good to go, right? We can go on and we can make policy and we can argue about things in public and we can do Supreme Court rulings and stuff. Because his hope is we can get the common ground by finding a very minimalist thing, basic common denominator. The problem is that so many people don't recognize that as justice still, right? Because he articulates the common denominator in the language of freedom, fundamentally, and liberty. Well, if you're a Marxist or a Catholic or any number of people, it's not really about that's not the basic level of justice, right? Nevertheless, there is perhaps grounds to hope that as long as somewhere in our list of, well, what is justice, there's enough overlap on those kinds of things, we've got something to start with. We're still going to have to go in and argue about, about all the principles, right? But we've got a place to start because we found some fair terms, right? Is we're at least going to be willing to start the conversation on those grounds. I'm disposed to think that... although I do believe there is a truth about justice, there is a true account of justice. None of us have it yet. I'm inclined to think I'm closer to it than people who disagree with me, but then everybody else thinks the same thing. But there's enough disagreement that one of the key things is to keep the conversation going and to not too hastily start excluding different approaches. Right? It's a danger that Rawls says is, I found the lowest common denominator, now we can say, just leave everything else out, right? Don't bring it into Parliament. Don't bring it into the voting booth. Don't bring it into court. If you have all sorts of other beliefs about justice, that's fine. Keep that in the private, right? And in public, we're going to work with this. That's too hasty, right?
Criteria for removing specific things. Like, how do we... Yeah. Say what somebody's bringing to the table is relevant to our discussion of justice, and where is something that isn't.
Yeah, and the one of the difficulties is that it's impossible to carry on a conversation with absolutely everybody. There are people who don't belong at the table; they're unreasonable, right? Right. We're all good, reasonable people here, but there are some unreasonable people, and we shouldn't be weighed down with having to argue with them. Right, and I've got no recipe for doing this,
right.
But a lot of modern philosophers have been working on this, is how do you create those terms in which, everyone gets a fair shake at participating in the conversation and influencing the outcome without just throwing the net completely open in such a way that, unreasonable people aren't there,
right?
Where to fit the criteria. I think Rawls does it wrong. I think Habermas is closer, but doesn't get it right either.
And going back to this question of whether or not these definitions of justice lose strength when we try to find the common ground.
Yeah.
So, for instance, let's say it just so happens that the common ground rejects some sort of like strong theist commitment. Would you be willing to accept that?
That's a good question.
Justice.
I would not like to.
Right. But would you be willing to?
Sometimes, yes, and under certain conditions.
Right.
Right. I'm more understanding now. Right, the losing its force. Right. There are times under which we all should show some restraint. Right, and conditions under which we should all practice some restraint. And one of those conditions is, well, what's it actually going to, is it going to help things to talk about it? Right. If I was in a room full of convinced atheists and I came in here and just started quoting scripture to them in order to convince them about my view of whatever. Right? Pointless, right? And it kind of rude, too, right? But if that was the only condition under which I could speak, is that I never appealed to my faith, I would feel like I was done unjustly by. Because in the end, we can both talk about justice and mercy, but when I say justice and mercy, I don't mean exactly the same thing that a Marxist does, right? There's interesting overlaps, and we may actually agree more about it than a liberal over there or something like that, right? And so there's lots of things. And so, Some of it's contextual. What are we arguing about? What are we discussing? Where? With whom? What are we trying to achieve? Right? Nice coffeehouse conversation like this, we can be pretty wide open. Right? You know, anybody can come from just about, you know, any position. We'll be respectful and nice about it. Hopefully we'll understand each other. Right? On the floor of the Supreme Court, maybe it's a good idea just to keep ourselves to talking about the law. Right? We'll just use that as the, you know, as the limits there. But there's that problem of principles of fundamental justice and stuff. But it's still, if I was a lawyer arguing at the Supreme Court, quoting scripture is probably not the best place to do it. It's not the place to do it. So some of those judgments are contextual. And we have to recognize the many different fora within which the conversations have to happen. But then be prepared to be generous with one another, right? And the danger of answering the initial question with a yes, secular philosophy says everything we need to know about justice, is that gives a justification for saying, well, regardless of the context, we don't need to listen to the religious people because they can't say anything we don't already know, right? And obvious, as a religious person, that would bother me.
And so this may be entirely out of left field. I'll be very honest. I don't have a philosophy background at all. I work in healthcare, so. Something that's come to my mind is, how do we come to a consensus on an idea of justice? When something that's come to my mind is that we all have different timelines in which justice is enacted. From certain faith groups, I'm coming from an Eastern tradition where this isn't my only lifetime.
Yeah.
And the idea of karma beyond a yoga studio is really informs my life and directs my life. So some people from that part of the world may say that justice is actually not a human decision. It's not something that's our responsibility that will be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And in other traditions, they may feel, well, how I'm acting in this world is going to be judged in another world, either in another life. And I think somebody who comes from an atheist perspective may say, this is your one and only life. And so the timeline in which justice is enacted, I just wonder, how does that actually play into coming to a consensus about justice?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't thought about it in those terms before. My hunch is that precisely because you come out of the religious tradition you did, you made me think about something I hadn't thought about before. This is exactly why my disposition is to say, make sure that religious voices are still allowed, and a plurality of them, because that's a really good question. Because one of the big disputes about justice is, how quickly do we have to move? How anxious must we be to do something about this, right? For some people, right, injustice requires we have to do something now, something big. There's dangers in that. There's very practical dangers of doing that. And in terms of the ability to achieve long-term justice, sometimes hurrying to do something too quickly, right, or to be obsessed with doing things at all, right? I'm not by any means an expert on Buddhism, but one of the things when I've talked to Buddhists, right, they sort of say, hey, are so funny, you're obsessed with doing things, right? And it's very hard for me, Western Christian person, to sort of turn off that we got to do something about this. I have no really good way of answering your question besides that's a really good framework within which to think about our conversations about justice. See, even our very practical ones, say about Ukraine and the intervention, of course we have to do something about this, but how hurriedly should we do it, right? You have to be seen to be acting quickly, right? There's so much criticism of Obama, right? He's showing weakness because he's not acting quickly and decisively like Ronald Reagan would have. We know how that worked out in some cases and in others as well, right? Is thinking about timelines with justice. There's an idea that really appeals to me, which is the idea of slow justice, right? Justice that doesn't necessarily translate into immediate, big, dramatic action, but the gradual reorientation of people's views of our institutions and our social practices, right, that can in the end have great, enormous consequences, but where all the changes are sort of incremental, they're often almost invisible, right? This is how I comfort myself when I teach philosophy, right? And so I end up, what do I do during the day about injustice? Well, I talk about it, right? in a very rarefied environment. Well, I like to think participating in slow justice a little bit, right? And that idea of slow justice, the long arc of the moral universe, it can be very easy to forget, and that's one of the great contributions of certain religious traditions, is they can remind us about the long arc of justice. Maybe. I don't know, was that...
I have a completely unrelated second question, is that okay? So, again, because of my background in healthcare, an issue that comes up a lot in medical ethics, I won't go into that too much, but just how do we come to a unified idea of justice in economic finite resources?
I don't know. I wish I did. But to a certain extent, one of the keys will be, in order to do this rightly, to make sure that there's an ongoing conversation and a conversation that is as inclusive as possible of different, quote-unquote, reasonable views on these things. The hurry to exclude certain views in the name of efficiency is often exactly the what gets us into these troubles in the first place. As for exactly how to do it, well, I have my views, but they're not by any means expert views. So,
what are your thoughts on that?
Speaking in my personal life may be different than in my professional life. So, in my personal life, I mean, I would say probably, I think when you're, I can only speak from a healthcare perspective, I don't want to go into that too much, but I think it's when you're a loved one, you're going to advocate very differently, as opposed to being a resource manager who now has to look at a more utilitarian approach, which in Canadian healthcare, which is what I'm used to, we have to face those decisions. And how money is allocated, and should you, you know, I don't want to go into this much, but should you keep somebody on a ventilator who has no meaningful recovery of their life, and that resource is being expended at the cost of maybe healthcare that could be provided to a number of people in another way? So I wear two different hats, depending on
your I mean, a lot of institutions have that kind of thing, right? Is the administration and the institution has to be, and rightly so, very concerned with making sure that things are distributed fairly, that finite resources are not completely tapped out on one thing or another. I was having a discussion with an MLA about this with a class a little while ago, right? He insisted very strongly about this kind of stuff. But the point of view of patients and families and so on is obviously going to be different. Again, justice requires that neither of those just sort of always win, that the imperatives of institutions, right, efficient use of resources, can't always override patient well-being, but patient well-being has to be compatible with, so you got to have, right, people like yourself who actually can wear both hats, who can cross back and forth, who can see things from both perspectives, and keep a rich dialogue. Very challenging for institutions, especially big ones like healthcare institutions, to keep that going. Right, I work for quite a small university, and this is even still an issue, right? Administration they rightly have to administer things, so they're concerned with administrative concerns. We faculty, on the other hand, we're concerned about the integrity of our curriculum and so on. Well, big challenges keeping the dialogue flowing between them.
Well, with all due respect, from the point of view of an agnostic, my perspective on justice is somewhat different. First, how can anybody be considered reasonable if you disagree with me?
Yeah.
What we have to do is come to some agreement on what justice is. To me, justice is being reasonable to other people. The golden rule. The golden rule is almost by itself enough for a principle of justice. If we agree, it's fine. If we disagree, we can fight, but we don't have to. One of us can walk out the door. So, things which I consider an injustice is for me what justice is. And that depends on the
to some extent, what happens depends to some extent on the society we live in. In a kingdom, power decides what justice is. Mm-hmm. It's just as bad in a democracy where the majority decides. If you are part of the majority, this is a fine place for you. If you disagree with the majority, it's almost impossible that you can receive justice. An example is how our concept of democracy should apply to Egypt, where the consequences of a vote from a fundamentalist Muslim majority, many people in the West would regard as being unacceptable. So democracy has to be something for the person who lives in the democracy.
Go ahead if you have more, by all means.
When we were developing language, it was the priests and the wise men who asked the questions.
Yeah.
They formulated answers. And they formulated answers with no idea of what the answer should consist of. They made things up, conjectures, which couldn't be tested. So the language has come to have a religious overtone, if you like. It's only because the wise men who formulated the language were also the people who formulated religion. They were asking questions which they weren't prepared to answer. They didn't have the knowledge.
They're in good company then, because that's what we all do.
I beg your pardon?
I said they're in good company then, because that's what we all do.
I think that's all I want to say.
Yeah, you touched on a lot there. The one thing, talk about democracy and stuff, is that precisely because democracy can just be another form of might makes right, right? Instead of the might of the king, it's the might, right? That's why we actually don't live in pure democracies, right? Is in the name of justice, we've actually tried to create systems where, people have, dissenters have rights and so on, right? And that's based on appeal to justice. It would be unjust to let might make right in any case, right? And so might can make decisions, but only if they're compatible with these sort of basic terms of justice. You can't oppress people, you can't persecute them, you can't on these and these and these bases, and we're still arguing about, you know, who gets these under what conditions and so on and so forth, right? But that's based on appeal to a justice as a standard that goes beyond simply we're the winners here or we're trying to win, right? We have these codes of human rights and so on, whether they in the end they're practically more useful than their trouble. We can argue extensively about at a different time. But there's an appeal to justice, right? That has created the kinds of political systems we've got. That it would be unjust for might to make right. And yet, we need might, right? We need to do things. And doing things requires power. So what's the way to make that power, the use of that power be most based on what's right rather than who is able to win? Judgment of most Western nations is that a sort of constitutional democracy is the best way to do it, right? Because then you have two things. You have basic protections of minorities, right? So that however powerful the majority gets, they can't do certain things to minorities. Having the majority rule on all other matters requires us to talk and engage with each other, right? We have elections campaigns, people raise claims, make promises, advocate for things, argue against other things.
And so that we actually, well, the idea is we reason together, right? Or we reason with each other when democracy is working well. And that's going to mean that the force, in the end, the force of politics, right, is going to be directed by reason rather than mere who can win, right? Whether that's what actually occurs, I'll leave to your judgment. But
we've seen a lot of cases where it hasn't worked.
Oh, yes.
Abortion, slavery.
Yeah.
These are things which the democratic society decided were either acceptable or not.
Mm-hmm.
I submit that what you say and what you think is not something which is criminally
right.
looked upon, but that unless, of course, you were advocating violence against somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as whatever I do doesn't hurt you or you or you, it's none of your business.
Yes, as a general rule, I think most of us accept that as a standard, right? The difficult cases, and it's the sort of the difficult cases which are by no means anomalous. The difficult cases are sort of showing where there's continual tension. Are where, well, what counts as harm? Right? Have I harmed you if I imply that your religious beliefs are false? Right? Some people may feel harmed by that. Other people may feel invigorated by it. Like, yeah, good, let's have an argument. Right? Have I harmed you if I suggest that your sexual identity is immoral? Some people feel very harmed by that, and some people don't. And those are hard cases. We can start, you know, we can have enough common ground to say we shouldn't be harming, our practice of speech shouldn't be harming each other. But, well, you know, what counts as harm, right? Because if you set up hate speech laws in order to prevent me saying things that hurt someone, then I may feel harmed because my freedoms have been infringed. And so we're going to have these conversations. And ultimately, they're conversations about justice, right? About what sort of harms are the kinds of harms that we simply can't accept, right? What are the harms that have to be overcome by force of law? What sorts of harms can we deal with without using the coercive force of law? I think that's a big one in modern harm days, right? Because definitely speech can harm people, but is it the kind of harm that you should have the law preventing and so on? Those are going to be, and it's going to invoke rather, as we push these conversations, they get to these deeper levels, right? So the appeal of Hobbes too in his own way, but Rawls's hope is that, oh, there's a basic common denominator. We can solve these problems by we all share these principles. I'm a bit skeptical of that. I think we need to go down to really deep disagreements, right? The problem is that we really disagree about that, right? So we have to, well, muddle through.
But does it matter? Yeah.
It does, because we actually have to solve this, right? We can't not resolve the question of whether, say, and I shouldn't use the first person here, right? Someone saying that, say, homosexuality is immoral is or is not harm. We actually have to decide this, right? Harm that justifies legal sanction. We can't not decide it. We have to. And not making a decision is a decision. And that's why, right, the need for the right conditions of conversation is so important. Because in the Middle Ages, appealing to custom as a way of sort of solving the problem might have worked. But we can't avoid people who we don't share customs with anymore, but we still have to live with them. We can't avoid people with whom we don't share religious frameworks anymore, but we can't avoid them, and so on and so forth. We can't avoid people who have who work with very different understandings of history and identity, and that's some of what's behind, I think, the Crimea problem. Right? It's not just about power politics; it's about identity. Right? Who am I? Right? What does it mean to be Russian? What does it mean to be Crimean, and so on and so forth? Right? We can't avoid the questions now.
They're competing virtues. So what happens? It's a whole issue of competing virtues and what happens where there's competing virtues and how do you get behind that to think through how to move. You speak.
Going back to homosexuality, mm-hmm. if it propagates AIDS, then it's unjust. If it's friendship between two people of the same gender, it's, to my way of thinking, completely acceptable.
Right. And there will be ample time, you know, and many people on all sides who are happy to disagree with you about that, or unhappy to disagree with you. And some disagreements we can just say we all agree to disagree, right? Sort of in private life, we can disagree as much as we like around these tables, and we all leave and we're all reasonably friendly and so on and so forth, and that's great. But when it comes to making decisions about the terms under which we're going to live together, right? And that's law, but it's also social custom, it's also all sorts of things like that. We have to make decisions, right? Those decisions hopefully are tentative, those decisions are hopefully fair, those decisions can be changed and all that sort of stuff, but we have to make some decisions. Either we're going to prosecute people for saying certain things or we're not. And that's what sort of pushes these things in. And that's why I'm so concerned with, I keep coming back to this idea of keeping open dialogue, dialogue that doesn't too hastily shut down any perspective. But that can just be a free-for-all, right? I sometimes, you know, the pessimist inside me just says, oh, great, we all talk at each other. No one changes their mind about anything, and we end up, what in the end up, we, what happens? We just end up competing to see who wins in the end.
Let me pick up a theme that you've alluded to a couple of times. Freedom.
Okay.
If you're not in favor of maximizing freedom, you're not being reasonable. If you are not maximizing freedom, you're defending compulsion. But compulsion is the opposite of reason. Therefore, people who are not trying to maximize freedom are not reasonable and can be left out of the discussion because they don't really believe in discussion.
That's very much the view of people like Rawls.
Exactly.
Right? And there's something to it. Compulsion isn't necessarily the opposite of reason. If compulsion is based on reason, right? So when we send people to prison for killing people, we're coercing them, but we're doing so rationally, right? It's justified. So justified coercion isn't the opposite of reason. So if I allow you to be free enough to hang yourself, right, like to give you so much rope that you can hang yourself, speaking figuratively, is that reasonable? Wouldn't it be much more reasonable to prevent you, to stop you from doing that? Because I see your, you know, so it's not necessarily, right, it's not that compulsion is the opposite, right? Generally, a reasonable society will be one where we're going to use coercion as little as possible. That's a good general rule. But the big question is the as possible. How far can we let people be free? Are we going to allow people to express loathsomely vile opinions about other people? Are we going to be able to, and so on and so forth, right? So I can see there's a great appeal in maximizing freedom in order to allow reason to make decisions for us. But coercing people can be reasonable too. When they're being unreasonable. And if you're advocating for something that I think is not just wrong, but sort of loathsome and vile, well then, I'd be quite right to coerce you.
Well, of course, freedom is relative. And we want to maximize freedom. We don't necessarily want to absolutize freedom, if that distinction.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you pretty well picked that up in just one of the last phrases that you suggested. Letting somebody have enough rope is not necessarily maximizing his freedom,
right?
Because he's going to use it against his freedom. Mm-hmm. But he's not being reasonable.
Right. And the difficult thing in social situations is we have to, you know, it's a good maxim not to judge others, but we can't not do it either. We have to make those judgments for each other. In families, we have to make those judgments for each other. Now, usually, hopefully, law doesn't get in there, but in legal situations, we have to make those decisions. We have to judge each other's, right? And so it can't just be a question, is this person acting freely? It's, is this person acting free, using their freedom in a way that's compatible with their basic dignity, with other people's basic dignity, with their flourishing, with their living a dignified, worthwhile life, and so on and so forth. And then, well, we're right back into the depths of those problems where we can't just appeal to maximizing freedom as the norm that's going to settle our problems for us. Right? I mean, I'll appeal again to this, you know, this whole case about the Arizona the law. You guys, many of you guys will have heard about it, right? The question about whether people can deny service to same-sex couples under certain conditions, right? Well, maximizing, which side maximizes freedom? It's not actually obvious which side is maximizing freedom. They both think they are. Right? But depends in what freedom consists, what uses of freedoms are acceptable, right? You bring in the relationship between freedom and harm, and all of a sudden, who's actually being harmed here? Both sides think they're being harmed. Now, we can get pessimistic then and go, I don't know, let's see who wins, right? In the end, there's no actual right answer. My absolutism is the hope that there is a right answer. And the earnest belief that the way to arrive at that answer is not to close down conversation, but to keep it open. But
I was just going to say that the first thing that came to my mind is the Second Amendment, and I think that that would be the crux of the argument of the NRA.
Yeah. Well, that's another. You know, it's similar things, right? Does my neighbor having a huge arsenal of guns make me more or less free? It feels to me like it's less free, but on the other hand, if the government came in and took all his weapons, he'd feel substantially less free. So what does maximizing freedom do? In the end, talking about freedom has to go to talking about the good, right? That's sort of my response, right, is, well, what's a decent, humane, dignified, worthwhile, flourishing way to live? Right, arming yourself to the teeth or exposing yourself to a certain amount of vulnerability. I'm disposed to the latter, right? But there's going to be people who disagree with me, right?
Well, it's been excellent. Really appreciate the care with which all of you have spoken and helped us think in a little more complex way. I invited Michael to do this very much because he is Dutch. And my view of the Dutch has always been tempered by what I see as one of the great symbols of being Dutch, which is actually the image on the Troost pipe tobacco pouch, where you see a man in stocks, which is a common Dutch form.
We still do it.
You still do it, yeah. I know you do it over at King's College.
Yeah.
In stocks outside the church, and somebody else, a good Christian brother, has come along and is offering him a puff on his pipe.
Yeah.
Troost, comfort.
Yeah.
It's a Dutch thing. So thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you, guys. I report my